Welcome to the Property Couch, where each week you get to listen to two of Australia's leading property experts. Bryce Holdaway, co-host of Location, Location, Location Australia on Foxtel's Lifestyle Channel, and Ben Kingsley, Chair of Property Investment Professionals of Australia, and the 2014 and 2015 Property Investment Advisor of the Year.
All right, folks, you're on the Property Couch, where each week Ben and I bring you the insider's guide to property finance and money management. Mate, welcome to the Property Lounge.
The Property Lounge?
Yes.
Yeah, where are we?
Mate, we're not actually on the Property Couch, are we?
No, we're not. We're in... I want to live in America.
We are actually in the Departure Lounge at the Dallas-Fort Worth International Airport.
We are.
En route for the brutal 15-and-a-half-hour flight.
All passenger Smith, please board gate 42. We will not depart without you arriving, passenger Smith.
That's correct.
Yes, so we might get a bit of that.
We might get a bit of that. So we are... We had a customer service conference here that went very, very well, Ben.
But
fair to say, Ivis didn't acclimatise to the body clock, so she's a bit grumpy.
For the first couple of days.
See, now you heard her. She just yelled out. She's
me.
I think it's a fair chance that we leave Dallas as friends, but by the time we land in Sydney, we might be enemies.
Mm, well, 15 and a half hours later.
15 and a half hours through the night on the red eye.
Half a day.
So, but anyway, we digress. But, mate, a couple of things before we kick off. Today is the beginning of November.
It is.
Or as it's often referred to, Ben?
Movember, mate.
Movember. So somehow you agreed, you got me to agree.
Yes, I did.
To do a tash.
Correct.
And
a mustaki.
Mustaka. So we are going to do Movember, and we're going to set a goal to raise $5,000.
$5,000 from our community.
From our community. So
with Men's Health.
And we are going to also contribute, Ben, aren't we?
Absolutely.
So we'll kick that in. We'll talk that through further in the
month. Yeah, we'll get the ball rolling. Yeah.
But you want to kick it off?
I'll kick it off.
Yep.
$500.
$500. All right.
That gets us on our way. How's that sound?
It sounds good, mate. So I'll kick in. You've kicked in at the front of the month. I'm going to kick in at the back of the month.
Beautiful.
So we'll bookend it, and we'll put our money where our mouth is. But that's a very good cause. So Movember, and Ivis is going to put it on all the socials, Ben, to show how ridiculous I'll look with a moustache.
That's the only reason why I did.
I saw you last year. You actually look.
It
suits you.
Yeah. Oh, no. I can grow a beard in a week.
Gives you that 1970s sort of. So, okay.
Salt and pepper too. It'll be a bit of salt and pepper handlebars.
Yeah.
This time around, I reckon.
You're going to go to the bars, are you?
I'll go to the bars.
All right. I'll just go anything that sort of grows in that region. So, hey, mindset minute today, man, for me, Ben.
What's my name?
mine is a Seth Godin, you know, the marketing genius.
The genius.
He's got a classic, dig your well before you're thirsty.
Mm.
So the context being that, you know, if I quote you, plan to become what you plan to become.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting, we caught up with a friend in America, didn't we? And he spoke about the fact that he, among with millions of Americans, don't have enough money in retirement.
No, they don't.
So they're playing a game of catch up, and that's actually a bit of a white knuckle ride for some of them. So I thought that'd be a nice little segue, you know, from that discussion. Just to remind everyone that, you know, Seth says it best, dig your well before you're thirsty. Don't wait until too late to set this up. You don't have to go aggressive. You can stay conservative. You know, you can plan this, and you can do it without having to put yourself into unfamiliar territory or into too much of a discomfort zone, Ben. But it's important that you plan now for what will be a long time you need to be retired. So that's my mindset minute today, folks. If it's never too late, and if you're thinking about doing it, Ben, if not now, when? And if not you, who?
Oh.
Something to ponder on the tail end of mindset minute. So
nice.
If not now, when? If not you, who? So there you go, folks. All right, today... we had the pleasure of catching up with Jeff Goines.
Yes.
Today.
An estate agent in Texas.
In Texas, to talk about real estate. And he came up with some really great stuff and some new stuff that we weren't familiar with. So we thought it might be a good opportunity to push record.
Mm.
Here it is, folks, our chat with Jeff and USA Real Estate. Well, Ben, here we are sitting by a pool here in our hotel in Dallas. We've just spent a few days at a conference, and we thought we'd take the opportunity to... first of all, enjoy a bit of sun, because we haven't seen it for a few days, have we?
We haven't. And if you can just listen, if you've got your earphones and you can actually hear the freeway behind us, a little bit of Dallas, downtown Dallas noise in the background as well.
But just to build some context around this conversation, as our listeners know, I've got two young boys, Ben,
yes.
Jack and Sam, and when we were looking for one day for a nanny to come over, we found a terrific nanny by the name of Haley.
Yes.
And she was an American. She was from Texas. She looked after the boys wonderfully. But what that meant is, Ben, while we're in Dallas, she said, "Oh, you should catch up with my dad." And I said, "Yeah, sure, no problem." And
what
said,
does he do? He's
yeah, exactly. And she said he's in the real estate game, he's an investor, and then straight away that pricked up our ears.
Yeah.
But that'd be a terrific opportunity to get a bit of local intel
yes.
on the American market. So first of all, welcome, Jeff.
Welcome, thank you.
It's a pleasure to have you. Yeah, it's a pleasure for you to be here. But look, we've got an audience of people in Australia who have an appetite for all things property, finance and money management. And you're investing in this market, and there are some key differences for the two markets, you know, the US and Australia. But I guess we should open by, you know, what's the appeal to you in terms of investing right now in the American market?
In Texas in particular, the market's just on fire. It's really hot. The kind of recession from post 2008 till now, Dallas has surged because its companies have consolidated to the central U.S. and Dallas offers a lot of advantages. So I was telling you earlier that State Farm Insurance moved their national headquarters here. Toyota North America is moving here. A lot of big companies, LinkedIn, different ones like that, and so. This market is hot. We've had 10% increases in value for 3-4 years running, and the rest of the country is not experienced quite that hot. Now, from an investor standpoint, I think that the people that have been residential or real estate investors, they've been aware that this is a lucrative opportunity all along. But I think some of the growth has brought other people into the market. And there's some other reasons. There are some TV shows, Flip This House, and some other things.
We get some of them, yeah.
And so people think, oh my gosh, I can do that. And so they jump in, and they're just people that help bid things up. Sometimes if they get in early enough and they're savvy, they do all right. But other times, you know, they lose.
So Jeff, you're saying that with those companies that are coming here, there has been a population story here as well, hasn't there? So,
yes.
So post the GFC, you had a oversupply, no confidence in the market. And for the listeners, we need to clarify one thing, and that is in America, they have, you know, basically their lending structures are different. We have full recourse lending in Australia, which means that if you basically borrow the money from the bank, you're responsible to pay that money back in terms of the bank won't own the security. Whereas obviously in the US, we call it, you know, basically the keys go in the jingle mail and they basically go back. So the banks take on that responsibility if the lender decides that it's too hard, isn't it? So
yeah.
That's a difference. So you can have this flood of supply coming back very quickly, and that's why you've got a bit more of a volatile market here.
That's very true, and that's happened at least two times in my adult life. Happened in the late 80s, early 90s, and then here in 2008. And we do have a more liberal lending. You know, the government does subsidize first-time owner occupancies. They subsidize the interest rates. And when things start to collapse, like they did in 2008 and back in the late 80s and 90s, the government steps in and bails people out. And they bailed out most of the big banks. And one of the things that did that you talked about is it regulates kind of that flux, that those huge swings. Mm-hmm. And so there was this huge supply of single-family housing that came onto the market that would have drastically depressed the prices, and it didn't. And it was because the government bailed the government out,
bailed the banks out.
And forced them to hold that REO, that real estate owned, to kind of bleed it off over time. It took 5 or 6 years. It wasn't until 2013, 2014 that inventory started to disappear and the regular market started to have its impact. And in addition to that, there was forgiveness given not only to the banks, but to the lenders or to the borrowers. Mm. So people, you know, they got forgiven. So we kind of cut our nose off despite our face in that we try and encourage this development and then overdo it and then live with the consequences of it. There's not a lot of stability.
But I think that that's a product of government and the economy trying to move forward. I mean, what a lot of people, you know, like in Australia, it's almost like property's too big to fail. We've seen what's happened, obviously the US had their GFC and that, you know, the GFC being global financial crisis, because obviously then Ireland and Spain and Portugal, all of these countries where credit became easy to access, we saw this massive price appreciation because of cheap credit. And that led to obviously, you know, a global recession. So, but importantly, the government recognises that when it gets too much, that they do step in, because ultimately value and people's prosperity are underpinned usually by residential property. So from that point of view, you've got this story that they know that if we keep letting it go and go and go, what base are we rebuilding from in terms of, and if we can't get construction jobs, well, the construction jobs leads to retail employment and just gets that economy moving in terms of manufacturing. People are starting to make couches again, they're making fridges, they're doing all this type of mattresses, you know, so ultimately we still need to live somewhere, don't we, Bryce?
We do, yeah. And so I guess for our listeners who don't understand American real estate, so we do 101, what are the places that haven't had, a better question, what are the better performing cities across the states? Is it because they've got, you know, you talked about Dallas before, but, you know, is it Dallas, LA, New York, the ones with the bigger economic bases, the bigger populations, and some of the other ones that don't have, maybe driven by manufacturing, are struggling? What would someone in Australia need to sort of think about if they were even considering investing in the US?
I think that the cities that show population growth and job growth and income growth, it's all combined. Mm. And then that plays on the inventory that's available. So there's been, for the last 15 years, there's been an exodus of California because it's just been so high there. And Texas has been a benefactor. Colorado was a benefactor. New Mexico was a benefactor of those exoduses from California. And there's been exoduses of other places, not because of high prices, but for job declines. You know, the Midwest, the Rust Belt in America is taking it on the chin because all the jobs have moved to the Southeast or overseas. And so,
you know, Detroit, we're talking about here, we're talking about all these, you know, big steel towns that are just basically, what do we call them? You know, they're relics of their former selves, aren't
they? Exactly. Yeah. Detroit used to be the fourth largest city in the United States, and I don't think it's as big as Fort Worth now. I mean, it's fallen out of the top 10.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's real estate 101. It's population, inventory, interest rates, income, jobs. Those are where those things are. And the U.S. economy, wage-wise, you know, we've been a net exporter of entry-level and low-skill jobs. So if you want a decent income, you need to be in a sector where there's income growth.
Yeah.
And those markets are generally in high-tech corridors, Austin, Silicon Valley, places like that. And some of the old bastions where there's money, maybe New York and whatnot, but those are smart markets, are so big and so developed that they're relatively stable.
Ben, there's a lesson there too in terms of economic activity, human interest, human behaviour, isn't there? In terms of if the economic activity is taken away, the human interest and the human behaviour, sort of, you know, using Detroit as that example.
Yeah, and Jeff talks about the inventory story, and that's the supply and demand story.
Right.
So again, you know, we talked about that supply basically finally being absorbed, and now we've got an economy that's doing really well. I mean, what's fascinating to me as someone who's a student of this whole property thing and looking at international markets is, in Australia, we don't have any mass cities that don't have a water port, you know, and we're sitting basically in a semi-arid desert with beautiful skies.
We can't go to the beach unless we drive for a long time. 5 days,
and I think we saw a cloud one day in that 5.
Yeah.
But, you know, so you're a dry port. But, you know, you only need to go for a drive on the way out to the airport and you just see these mass factories with just this container of, truck containers that are just lined up, not in 10 or 20 in a row, but we're talking 60, 100 truck containers in a row. Mm. So it really is a hub that also then feeds out to all the different ports, and you're also very close to Mexico and that sort of thing. So you've got a pretty low wage base for some of your service work, your cleaning work and your hotel work. I mean, we're seeing that here. So we're talking about minimum wage being around, is about $8, is that right?
$7.25, I think.
There you go, so $7.50. Now, our minimum wage in Australia, I think, just ticked over $19 an hour. So, you know, in terms, we talked about this before, in terms of median house prices in the US sitting at around $300, $350. If you took that's including the Silicon Valleys and the, and you know, so, and in Australia, we're talking median values now probably about 550, 600, relative to, well, we've got double your wage, and look at that, our median house price sort of sits about that, our retail interest rates sitting at around, sort of 3.5-4%. What sort of housing interest rates are you paying here for?
I think that's about the same. They're mid threes to five for residential owner occupied. It's kind of nudging up now that the Fed is kind of raising
their interest. Policy. Yep.
Yeah. And some of that's going to put some stabilizing pressure on those prices, because as the interest rates rise and the borrowing cost goes up, obviously the prices aren't going to accelerate as much. And I think people forget that the impact of that. I tell my friends, you know, income, interest, and inventory are the three drivers. And we've had historically low interest rates for residential real estate. And people, they get spoiled. They think, my house is worth this. And I'm thinking, wait till interest rates go back up. Your house is not going to be worth that. And again, to put this in perspective, my first house I bought in 1984, I borrowed money at 12.75% on a growth equity mortgage. And that was the best I could get, and that, people gag on that. Now they're choking, they pay 4.5%. I'm like, they want to refinance. I'm like,
Australia has that. We had high teens in the 90s, and now we've got very low rates, historically very low rates.
And let's spend a little bit of time on interest rates and mortgages. Is it true that the majority of your mortgages are more fixed for the entire term of the loan, or are they more variable? Are they a floating rate, or are they a fixed rate?
There's a variety. So you can get a fixed at 30 or 15 or sometimes 20.
20 years.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You can also get an adjustable. The adjustables are generally readjusted in 3 or 5 years.
Okay.
And they, in many cases, have a balloon so that there'll be an adjustment period, or you'll pay it off and then start all over again.
And have you heard of a concept called an offset? Do you have offsets? So in other words, you have your transactional account next to your mortgage. So if your mortgage has $100,000 in it and your transactional has $20,000 in it, you only pay interest that day on the 80. Do you have any of that sort of product?
I'm unfamiliar with that. I would love that.
Yeah.
I would go talk to my banker in a minute, because I'm really distressed that I don't get any interest on my cash in the short term, and I would leverage myself a lot better.
And what sort of leverage can you do on property here? Can you leverage, 60-70% on the equity and take that money out to potentially grab another property?
Yes and no. First of all, the lower interest rates are on owner occupied. If you try and borrow money on investment property, it's going to jump substantially. Easily over 5, but it's probably going to be closer to 10.
Eight to
10%. Yeah.
If you declare that it's for investment purposes, even though it's secured against a resi property, they're going to sting you almost double.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. So is that like lines of credit as well? So
yes.
So when you're taking out a line of credit which is secured against a residential,
I'll give you an example. A house I just sold here locally, I paid cash for it. I rehabbed it with cash, and I thought it made economic sense long-term for me to hold it.
Yeah.
It's in an appreciating market. I would cash flow. Even if I pulled my money out, banks wouldn't talk to me. They want the lease seasoned a year.
Yeah.
And they want a full disclosure of my financial statements and, you know, yeah, my firstborn. Yeah. And I was like, you know, in the time it's taken me to do this, I'm going to go do another deal and make more money.
Mm.
So I sold it to another investor who's benefiting from the cash flow of it, but I got my cash out. And so we have what we call hard money lenders.
Yeah.
And they'll charge you a point a month, so you pay 12% a year.
And we've got a few of those, but they're more for distressed borrowers than
So it's not quite as easy to be a real estate investor and borrow money. In fact, a great example, the people that bought the house that I just sold, when I talked to their lender, I said, can I borrow? And the loan officer said, they're not borrowing the money against the property. They're borrowing the money off their income. Really high income people could cover all their living expenses and still were so far under the loan value ratios that they could buy a second one. And I thought, wow, what an enviable position. I wish I had that income level.
So they're just lending basically unsecured. And what sort of rates are they getting unsecured for?
I don't know that off
the top of my head. That's interesting. Because obviously the Australian model is, if you're going to accumulate a portfolio of properties, you would normally allow the access to equity in the existing property. And because the banks have obviously got a pretty low volatile asset, they are a little bit more comfortable. We're seeing rates going up between, you know, sort of maybe 100 basis points different between owner-occupier and investor. But at one point there, they were basically at par.
Oh man, I would have a field day with that. and part of the reason for this is the banks have been stung.
Totally.
They got bailed out, and the borrowers have been forgiven.
Well, the Fed Reserve doesn't want them to be so flippant about giving their money, do they?
And rightfully so. But as a savvy investor who's conservative with his money, I'm like, you know, loosen up a little here for me. If they loosen up for me, they loosen up for everybody, and all of a sudden we're in the same mess we were.
Don't think you're ever going to be treated as an individual from a bank, Jeff. I mean, let's all be honest. I don't think they might know us an individual on a name because they've identified us, but we're never going to get that love as, do you know who I am?
So, Jeff, you found a niche here that you've got involved in, tax deeds. Yeah. Can you explain what that is?
Mm-hmm. Tax liens and tax deeds are ways that investors can benefit from the delinquent taxes of real estate. So, for example, in many states, they're tax lien states, and what that means is that if somebody doesn't pay their taxes, the taxing authority will issue a tax lien certificate, basically give the lien against the taxes to an investor in exchange for the payment of the taxes. So when the taxes are made good, when somebody actually comes and pays their taxes, the penalty actually gets paid directly through to the investor. So the investor has a secured tax government-backed certificate, and if in fact the property owner doesn't pay the taxes, the tax lien certificate holder owns the first lien position, the government's position, above a mortgage, above anything else.
So they're the first creditor.
Mm.
Now, I think we need to explain this a little bit more, Jeff. So in Australia, so obviously our listeners know that we pay rates. Okay, so our rates notice goes to our local council. So it's a similar type of thing. We don't pay any land tax when it's owner-occupier. So whereas that land tax goes to the state, to the government. So, but here you actually pay an ongoing tax each year on your property. And that's what we're talking about here. So this rates or this this tax obligation needs to be paid by the owner of the property on an ongoing basis, which means you don't have any capital gains events. So if you sell your property, there's no big capital gain, which you then have to pay out of tax. But that doesn't go as part of your income for that year. If you're an owner-occupier, is that right?
Right. The capital gains is exempt from
your
homestead property. That's correct. Mm. Now, real estate investment, that's not true. If I have a capital gain on an investment, it's regular income in the first year. If it goes over a year, it's considered regular income.
That's right. But we pay a thing called stamp duty at the start of buying the property. And that's about 5 to 6% of the value of the property in a lump sum amount. So our state governments who collect our land taxes get this bonanza of these huge, I mean, we're talking $30,000, $40,000, $50,000, $60,000 for every transaction once, whereas you're paying that over the life of owning that property.
I don't know if they have this saying in Australia, but in the United States there's a saying, the only certainties in life are death and taxes. And my father is quick to remind me, he said, you don't really own anything. The government owns it because you quit paying your taxes and they will come and take it from you. And this actually predates the United States. I mean, even in colonial times, you paid taxes to the local taxing jurisdiction, and if you failed to do that, they would auction your property to the highest bidder for the taxes and let somebody else take the property. And I can appreciate that, because you have to, instead of these bonanzas on the front end, there is inflation. There are additional services, you know, there's infrastructure that needs to be built, and the taxes have to kind of track with that. And so the firemen need to be paid, the libraries need to be paid for, the school teachers, you know, all the things, all the taxing jurisdictions. And this niche that I try and exploit, I redeem these properties to put them back in use, and the authorities are happy to have me come in and invest and buy their deeds or these lien certificates, because A, they get cash flow, you know, they're not holding the bag anymore. But I'm not going to let this property sit negligent, or, you know, I'm going to put it back to work. And I feel good about that. There's a redeeming quality to that. Good housing stock. It, for example, one of the things I look at when I buy properties, the schools, the crime rates, you know, is this something that I can really enhance the local area with? And I want to buy the worst house in the neighborhood if I can. And I'm not able to do that all the time, but if I can buy a house that, if I turn that house and the values around it go up, I'm happy, not only financially, but I make good neighbors, and people will work with me again.
So, but are you buying it and then, you said rehab or refurbing, and then moving it on, or are you trying to keep it long term? I know you said it was tough.
I'll do both. It really depends on the circumstances. This one I used an example earlier. I really wanted to hold it and pull my cash out and do the other deal, but it was too difficult to get my cash out. And so I was like, well, forget that. I'll just move on and do the next deal. But some deals really lend themselves to holding. This one we're probably going to close on here in the next few days, it's going to be hard to flip that. It's going to be an ideal hold.
So an indicative yield on a property like that, what are we talking about? Are we talking 10%?
Well, in Texas, which is a tax deed state, let me back up. Tax lien certificates are penalties that are paid to the investor with their capital return when the taxes are paid, and if not, the tax lien holder gets the property. Tax deed states, basically, it's auctioned and you actually get the deed. The returns are better in tax deeds, and it's determined by the state legislature. So we have tax lien states, and then we have tax deed states, and then there's some hybrids. Texas is a tax deed state, and the penalty, the redemption penalty, if I buy a property and someone wants to redeem it, they have to redeem my investment plus 25%, and 25% on it on top of anything I spend on the property to preserve or secure the property. So it's a great secure position to be in, that I have a deed that says I get to use and possess the property, and it, for the window of time that they could redeem it. If they do redeem it, I'm guaranteed a 25% return. Now, if that's the bottom, really. If I can't make 25%, I'm not really playing. And so I was telling you, this deal I made mid-40s. I really was shooting for 50 and was almost there, and had a last few-minute deals that kind of cost that kind of put it down there.
But it's effectively saying that as the number one creditor, if the person who is due that credit, you will still get a 25% margin because you've carried them. So in other words, if they find the money some way to retain their property, so maybe like a mortgagee sale is the best way to describe it in Australia, because that's the sort of only way we can see that sort of stuff happening. But you have mortgagee sales as well. So you could be up to date on your rates and your taxes, but you could be behind on your mortgage. So there's effectively three ways you can be struck out.
Right.
And but there's no guarantee on the credit on the mortgage, though, is there? Like, you're not getting a... Because obviously I can understand the states are basically saying you're helping cash flow the society, so I'm going to give you an incentive for taking on that risk because we don't want to put it on our balance sheet as a debt.
Mm-hmm.
Yep, okay,
right.
Interesting.
Now, what's interesting is a lot of times the lenders will come in and buy it at the tax sale
just to protect
their interest, because in many cases the lenders are accruing or escrowing the taxes. Most people that borrow the first time, the banks, the mortgage companies escrow the taxes and insurance and sometimes other things, private mortgage insurance, if in fact they borrowed higher than the loan-to-value ratios that are allowed. But what's interesting is banks don't always show up. We're looking at a house this coming sale next week that's owned by a bank.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like...
Well, they're unlikely to show up, aren't they?
Well, we passed on a deal last month where we had the owner of record who was willing to sell us the house at a huge discount, and we would go pay the taxes and it would...
Work out well.
We would avoid the tax sale, and we wouldn't have to deal with the redemption period. Well, when I did a little title work, there was still a mortgage leaned against the house, so I couldn't find a release. And so I told my partner, the mortgage company's going to show up and make good.
Yeah.
Well, they didn't.
Mm.
And I was like, I hope that...
But does that carry on to you then? I mean,
No. So whoever bought it, that mortgage got wiped out. So that mortgage...
So that's a bad debt for the bank.
Yes.
Effectively. And
yes.
They're happy to take it. And so, I mean, obviously we're not playing in that $500,000 space here, are we? We're right down sort of...
They can get up there. Surprisingly, there's some commercial buildings. I drove by an office building coming down to this meeting. $1.5 million small office building, two stories on the freeway. It's on the tax roll for sale this month, $87,000 minimum for $1.5 million building.
Wow.
Now, so...
We might have drive past that one when we go into town.
Take us for a spin.
So, yes, most of the time, you're at the bottom
to
the middle. But not always.
What's the typical value? What's the typical value?
The things I'm looking at are generally $100,000 to $150,000.
Yep.
So they're kind of starter homes, maybe first step up homes.
Yep.
And the original owner's not in them, are they? They're vacant.
Sometimes they're occupied. Mm. Like this month, the particular county we're looking at has really 20 properties, and I could show you the kind of details on them. And all of them are between... Just maybe under $100,000 to $250,000. Most of them $100,000 to $150,000.
Mm.
And of the few that we've actually done a physical inspection on, I bet 80% of them are occupied.
Mm. Okay.
And
by the owners or by a rental?
I can't tell
you.
Yeah,
you're not gonna. So they'll have to be moved on.
Well, I can tell you some because they're homesteaded. If you get a tax break, if you're an owner-occupant, and that you can find in the tax records.
Yeah.
And so if it's homesteaded, I assume that, if they're not owner-occupied, they're going to lose the homestead, and it's going to be to my advantage because the redemption period's shorter.
So do you then try and talk to them directly and see if you can come to an arrangement?
Yeah. In fact, this afternoon and this week, I'll be trying to talk to several of those people to preempt, what we call preempt, the auction, because they either need to come up with the cash and pay their bill, or they're going to lose the property, whereas I can sweeten the deal and give them a little money to go away and then go pay the taxes, and I get the property at deep discount and I don't have to deal with the redemption period.
Yeah.
And there are a couple that we've targeted because the tax bills are really sizable considering the value of the property. So property that's on the tax roll for $108,000, $110,000, they got a $27,000 tax bill.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I'm like,
And what happens? So they have to declare they're bankrupt. Would they? I mean, because obviously, you don't want any victims in this. You want to try and get a win-win, don't you? I mean, ultimately, you're not sort of preying on the vulnerable. You're trying, and hence you'll go and talk to the vendors about a way in which you can make good, give them a little bit more, get them on their way.
I'll give you a great example. I want to be benevolent. I want to not only redeem the real estate, I want to redeem people's lives and homes and whatnot. Deal I did, it was a home that was inherited. and the family was estranged, and one of the family members still lived in the home and hit hard times, couldn't pay the taxes and couldn't really pay anything. And so I end up with his house on the tax sale, and he's living in it. And I worked with him for several months and said, I don't want the house vacant. And, you know, if you work with me, I'll put the house back in shape and we'll go from there. And we did that for a little while, but then he started to skirt the issue and he wasn't available and things got crosswise, and he was pleading poverty in that he couldn't do things. And I was like, well, I can help you with that if you allow me to do that. But before we go there, let me make this clear. Here's what I paid for the tax deed. Here's what the redemption cost is for you. Tell me what you think the house is worth. It was substantially more than that. I said, well, there's only three people involved in this transaction. Me, who own the current tax deed, you, who can reclaim that deed, or the county. And the county already given it away once.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
They don't want it this, so it's me and you. And if you think it's worth this, and it cost this to take me out of the picture, you're not poor.
Mm.
You know,
yeah,
this
yeah.
is a sizable chunk of equity. He said, but I don't have access to that. And I said, well, you can go down to the end of the street, because you're the deed holder here, and you can borrow what it takes to get me out and then walk across the street and list this house and sell it and make that equity and go on your happy way. I'm happy, you're happy, the county's happy, the bank's happy, the realtors are happy, everybody's happy, the new owner.
Yeah,
he couldn't figure out
that is a classic win-win, but he just needed some guidance and some coaching.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you get your minimum return on the deed that you hold. He gets to sell the property legitimately through natural courses, and he gets to pocket the inheritance, and away he goes.
Many people, for whatever reason, don't manage their assets well, and they get in these situations. Mm. And they, you know, I'm envious of you guys in Australia who have realty advisors that kind of make it a financial. It's like your financial planner. And we don't have such a thing here. Particular to the real estate. Our homes as assets are on our balance sheet, and in most cases it's the highest, it's the biggest asset that most of us have, but it's also not getting any return, and it's a lag on the system because it's being taxed at such a high rate.
Now, Jeff, the other thing that we've looked at the US market a couple of times for our clients, and we've sort of said, look, you know, there's so much opportunity in Australia. You're getting complexities around exchange rates and all those types of things. But the other thing that we also thought was a difficult piece for the long-term hold, because we play the long game. We've always said to our clients that, you know, we don't speculate in property. It's the long game. Yes, you can manufacture growth, but it's not investing. It's work, and someone's doing that work. It's a job, so you've got to get reward for that. But property management also. So we have, you know, in Australia, we have a Real Estate Agent Act, and there's, you know, property management, there's trust accounting, there's all of that stuff going on. So very professional structure and regulation. What about in the States? I mean, the research and reading that I've done is there doesn't seem to be that sort of level of sophistication in terms of managing residential property.
Yes and no. I watched Bryce's webcast on your webpage, and one of his hints was hire good property management.
Yeah.
And I worked in that industry, so I'm a strong advocate of good property management. And there are good property management companies. Now, property management as a whole is almost a stepchild, though. It's not looked at as very profitable. And in the local Real Estate Investors Association, for example, the president will say that property management is a minimum wage activity, that you as an investor don't need to be bothering with. You can slough that off to somebody else because you're not going to pay very much for that. And I had to cringe when she said that, because I worked in that industry, and to a degree there's a certain amount of truth to that, because you're underappreciated and underpaid, but you do bring real value to the, and Bryce is right in his webcast, they're worth every penny you pay them. And unfortunately, not a lot of people really develop themselves in that market and whatnot. There are associations in the United States. National Association of Realtors has some sub-organizations, the Institute of Real Estate Management, and they have different designations, and you'd do well to find people that have those designations, certified property manager, or another designation is a certified commercial investment member. They would be the closest thing to property advisors, but they're more...
Because commercial, it's no worries.
Yeah.
It's just resi.
Yeah.
So, Jeff, we come from Melbourne. It's the auction, you know, touted as the auction capital of the world. What does an auction look like here for you? Is it in-room? Is it on-site?
Great question. Texas, by statute, by state law, the auctions are held on the courtroom steps in the county seat.
Right.
Now, or a place that they designate, but they still do that. So,
on the steps.
Yeah, the courthouse steps. Now, understand that Texas is the second largest state in the United States, and if the continental U.S. is the size of Australia, Texas would probably be, I don't know, it's certainly bigger than Victoria, maybe.
Western Australia.
Yeah, it's a huge, huge, it has 256 counties. And each county has to hold their own auction, and it's the same day at the same time, and so
it makes event.
well, each county. Yeah. So there are potentially 256 auctions going off simultaneously in these counties, which for an investor is just a pain in the rear end because
you can't stagger it.
Exactly. And so my partners and I are trying to figure out how can we be in more than one place at the same time. And what we end up doing is we have to cherry pick the counties. So we're looking at the tax auctions on a monthly basis and say, the inventory that's available this month is better in this county. So we go to that county. And next month it shifts over here and it's this county. So it makes it very difficult to kind of localize your investment. A lot of the local investors say real estate's a local deal, you have to pay attention to the local thing. And that's true. But if you're a tax deed investor, you kind of go where the inventory is available. And so we have to be mobile to get the kind of returns that we want going that way is to our advantage.
Yep.
Because a lot of these better returns are in places that other people just, they go, I'm not going there. I'm not looking there.
Are you seeing these opportunities in Texas because you're a Texan, or is it because it's the best opportunities in the country? I mean, are there better, are there better opportunities on the East Coast or the West Coast? Or is it just stay local?
Well, for me, it was stay local because I want to put my eyeballs on it. I want to be able to get in the car and drive to it, even if it's 3 or 4 hours away. And I don't want to have to bother myself with different state jurisdictions, and they do change by state. Now, that's not to say that I won't eventually, but right now, in the beginning, while I'm building the capital up, Texas is the place to be. Not to mention that Dallas-Fort Worth, the Metroplex, what we call the Metroplex, is the hottest market in the country. And so, and I'm getting outbid most of the places, but on the fringe is where I find markets.
You see some opportunity. Because, I mean, when, you know, I looked at Detroit and I looked at, you know, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac and all of that, and I, you know, I used to do presentations years ago that I could buy 5 properties on my credit card for under $10,000 US, and just to sort of highlight the deterioration of certain markets. And when you don't have jobs, if you don't have an economy, you absolutely don't have price appreciation from that point of view. We've got a local little neighbour up in the tree, haven't we, Ivis?
Ivis is freaking out. She's going, I can't fix this.
It's only a bird. It's only a bird.
She's been walking trying to pick it off.
But it's at an eagle, is it? Oh, it is too.
Oh, it is an eagle.
Yeah, it's a little... Oh, they're very cool.
I obviously need to get that on, get that on social.
Go and take a photo of it. Anyway, so some of the markets that we also looked at were a lot of these. So the biggest markets that had the biggest deterioration were Arizona, Florida, all these what I call lifestyle markets that were just booming at the time where cash was free, you know, so people were going down to Nevada and spending time in Las Vegas. And so Las Vegas was booming because all the big rich guys were making all these mega bucks and coming down, and, you know, life was good in the heady days. So they were markets that I always said, if you're going to go into the U.S., just avoid those markets.
Well, I would counteract that with, those are great markets for tax liens.
Yeah.
And because there's such a turn, you can make a heyday. A lot of the people that are in my business make a living in Florida and Arizona. Both of those states, you can buy tax liens on online. and they're not like Texas where you have to be there in person. Yeah. So they know those markets, they live in those markets, and they just make a field day. But it's just the tax.
I was going to say, it's not investing in property.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, we need to be very clear about here. Yeah. It's, you know, you're investing in opportunism.
Yeah. So on that, what are the barriers to entry? I mean, is it just mindset doing what you're doing? If the opportunity exists, if someone, is it just their mindset that gets in the way, other than obviously having some basic resource to kick it off? Is it popular what you're doing? No.
What I'm doing is highly unique. People kind of get frightened away by the taxing authority and the statutes, and dealing with the local tax man.
It's technical.
Yes,
very technical. You know, like I've just heard you talk about checking, you know, ownership, checking mortgage, you know, like, and that information is probably not on the net. You've got to go and find it, shuffle around some of it, and you've got to know the technical elements of it.
Yeah, and I paid good money to be trained to kind of know what the gotchas are.
There you go.
So can you lay out a 101 for the listener, because they're all listening to these new things for the first time, but you know for clarity, you're buying the deed or the land. Can you give an example of numbers, what that would actually look like?
Yeah. Well, first of all, let me just talk about the process. In Texas, if people are delinquent in their taxes, they have to be delinquent in their taxes 3 years before the taxing authorities will actually file suit in the civil court, and they'll get a judgment against the property owner for those taxes and the cost associated with that. And the district judge will order the county constable to auction that property after the proper notices to satisfy the judgment. And that's what a tax sale is. And like I said, they all happen at 10 a.m. on the first Tuesday on the courtroom steps or other places that the constable designates. So it's 3 years' taxes plus fees. A single-family home, modestly priced, is going to have $1,500 to $3,000 worth of taxes a year. And so a minimum bid, a judgment amount, is going to be $5,000 to $9,000 or above, depending on if they got delayed or whatnot. So that's kind of the starting point. But then they're auctioned. And they generally auction off somewhere between maybe a third to a half, maybe 60-70% of the value, depending on the condition of the house and the location and whatnot. And so if in fact it was occupied and didn't really need any rehab, you could see somebody paying 70%. And the reason is that if somebody wanted to redeem it, if they had enough emotional attachment to the house, they'd have to pay the 70, you know, what they paid plus the 25% penalty and basically rebuy their house. Now that's not very common. Most of the time they're, like I said, at a third to a half. And that's kind of where we look. We say, you know, is it above that or below that? And in some cases, we're shooting just above that, but in most cases, we're shooting below that. Because the properties are pretty rough. I mean, people that can't pay their taxes aren't taking care of their property, and so you've got to accommodate for that. Mm. And if we do a decent job of
rehabbing it.
Is the rehab just carpet and paint, or are you having to do structure?
I've never restructured. I kind of shy away from the ones that... so when we we do drive-bys or inspections, you know, we're looking at foundation damage or roofs, are the windows intact, you know, the air conditioning system in place. You know, there are places where, and, you know, we don't buy, where people, you know, they vandalize the house, they'll pull the copper, they'll pull the plumbing, you know, they'll be hobos. I mean, it's just, you know,
that's like copper's worth a bit in the recycled metal market, and that's what they do, they pull it.
Yeah, and so we stay away from that, and we wouldn't want to be in a neighborhood that had that anyways. No. But we're buying cheap enough, as one of my trainers said, you're buying low enough that price is, you know, forgives a lot of mistakes. The other thing is, you can't get, that's why some of these other bidders surprise me, because I don't know what they're looking at. I'm like, you must have been inside, or because, I mean, you can't be bidding that much blind. I mean, because you're not going to make any money at that price.
Yeah.
So, And generally, those people have an ulterior motive. One of the first auctions I went to, I couldn't believe it. The rest of us were all stunned. We're standing there, and this guy, these people are just bidding this up, and it was like 80, 85% of the market value of this house. And we're like, what's, you know, do they have gold buried under this?
There's oil underneath. We are in Texas.
And the builder I was there at this auction with, he said, I can't believe this. And so he went over and asked the winning bidder, he said, you know,
what happened?
Yeah. And he was an investor that owned property in that neighborhood, and he wanted this house for his son because this particular property had a large metal garage in the backyard, and his son kind of had a backyard.
There's the emotional owner-occupier appeal value.
And I'm thinking,
human behavior right there.
I'm thinking, you could have paid a lot less if you would have just gone to the county 2 weeks ago and given them their minimum.
So, that's incredible. Now, Jeff, in terms of, we talk on the podcast about owner-occupier appeal and that type of thing. So, and we've sort of said this around the world, that if you go to certain bigger city locations, and we're talking about Dallas being, you know, a growing big city, Fort Worth just down the road, with the areas where there's lots of status, lots of owner-occupier appeal, do you see the values of those homes going up proportionate to the wealth that's being generated in the community for those areas? I mean, do people buy on status, and is the land value in those areas at a premium?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
So the fundamentals work.
It doesn't matter,
human interest, human behavior, strong incomes, people want to live on a certain street or want to live in a certain suburb, and they'll pay a premium there from an owner-occupier point of view.
Mm-hmm.
So, yep.
And to be honest, the economics for building are better in those areas because people know that the returns are going to be better on the fringe, and so it's kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy. Mm. One of the frustrations I have is, you guys didn't ask me this, but I grew up the son of a carpenter, a builder, and I was 18 years old and got a builder's license.
Mm.
And so I kind of know how things go together. And my partner and I'll say, I really like this house. And he's like, well, the market's not there. And I'm like, I don't really care about the market. The house is solid.
Yeah.
You know?
And
he's like, well, we're you got to sell the sizzle. You know, it may be a prime cut, but if it's not sizzling.
Had a special guest on the podcast, Ben. Yeah, we had a few people just walking past us.
Checking out the pool. Now, but that does ring true. One of the other things I found is the cost of, so I'm renovating at the moment, you know, and our kitchen, you know, we're not going to get any change out of about $45,000.
Ben's keeping the Melbourne economy going right now with this renovation.
But it's not unusual. I mean, we're talking about, we had quotes of $80,000 or $90,000 for a kitchen.
Mm.
And you could buy a house in the States for that sort of money.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas, because obviously you've got great labour cost, and most of it's in the labour,
mm-hmm.
not so much in the material, but you've got cheap material cost here and you've got good labour cost. So you can fit out a really smart kitchen here for like $4,000 or $5,000, can't you?
That'd be
tight. That's tight, is it?
Yeah,
okay, so
yeah.
So mine.
It depends on if you take out the appliances. No, it's still too tight.
Still too tight. So $5,000, $6,000, $7,000, what are we talking for a full kitchen gutter and refit?
Well, it depends on what standard. If you're putting granite or
just basic, laminate.
Yeah, a laminate, you're going to spend, I spent $1,000 to $1,500 on a countertop.
Yep.
Sinks are a couple hundred bucks. Cabinets, you can buy cheap, but you're getting what you pay for. I cringe. In fact, when the house that we lived in that we sold a year ago that Haley grew up in, we remodeled the kitchen, and some of the contractors came in and said, well, we need to tear these cabinets out. I'm like, and show them the door, because they're solid wood cabinets that were just dated, and basically we put new faces on them and new drawers with glides, and you know, they're just solid, whereas this press board that they sell stuff, there's no wood in it. Or it's composites.
MDF or chipboard, okay.
And it looks great for about a year and a half until things, you know, the pull comes out, and then all of a sudden you're like, I need to buy a new drawer. And then you realize, well, I can't just buy the drawer, I gotta buy it. And all of a sudden you're right back there. So the quality does make a difference.
But painting costs and general carpeting costs and all that are significantly lower than what we see in Australia.
Okay, but there's a point I wanted to make when you were talking about that. One of the things about rehabbing is the material cost is not different in locations. If I want to buy a sheet of plywood, you know, or tile, or, and I'm in Dallas, Texas, or I'm in Podunkville, there's no discount being in Podunkville.
It's
the same cost. And so the upside
isn't as great for the the renter. Okay.
You can understand why you get to the outskirts or these markets that don't have the lifestyle appeal. There's kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy that they're not going to get retrofitted. In Dallas, there's kind of proof of that. There's areas on the south side of town that have been underdeveloped for years and years and years and years and years and years and years. And it wasn't until this uptown north of the river and everything is just totally saturated that it's actually crossed over into what they call it. They don't even call it Oak Lawn anymore because that has connotations. It's now the Bishop Arts District. You know,
status thing.
Yeah,
drop the old bad name that has a
human behavior.
Well, and the city fathers have got wise too. There's right here. I mean, within a mile of where we're sitting, what used to be Industrial Boulevard got renamed Riverside.
We can put the rates up. The land value's just gone up.
Exactly.
We've just changed the name.
Okay. Ben, I think we could chat for ages, but Ives has given us the look. We've got to jump on a plane and do the 15 and a half hour trek back to Sydney. But Jeff, it's been terrific. We just thought it'd be really great, you know, give our listeners an opportunity to get an American perspective, a Texan perspective, on real estate. And
it's been my pleasure. I hope I haven't misled anybody, and if I can be more help, feel free to contact me again.
That's terrific. And you've got a terrific daughter. She's looked after our kids very, very well, so just put the little plug in there for Haley. But Ben, so that's been fun.
Yeah, it has been great. Thank you very much, Jeff.
You're welcome.
Good on you. Thanks, Jeff. All right, so that was a really good chat, Ben. He was really gracious with his time. He took us around.
Wasn't it? I mean, what I really loved about it, you know, in digesting it again and thinking about it, is fundamentals are still true.
Mm.
But interesting that, you know, there are other opportunities in this market that we don't have in the Australian market. So we have, obviously, mortgagee and possession sales. But the market seems a lot freer over here, and obviously they don't pay stamp duty, we pay stamp duty, but they have these liens and these tax debts,
deeds
that they can buy and potentially make a dollar out of. So pretty interesting. I think it's probably highly speculative, and we need to remind our listeners that, you know, this is not finance advice. Don't rush out there and...
Well, it's more just that, you know, as you know, Ben, our community's got a real thirst for learning and for understanding. So it just gives them exposure to another market, which I think is not a bad thing. But you're right. We always talk about, if you're a sophisticated investor and you've got, you've done your accumulation and you're building the portfolio, you can potentially look at some of these other things. But early days, there's plenty of opportunity now.
You've got to do your DD, don't you? Due diligence, you know. So from that point of view, it's just great to see how other markets work. And that's why we thought we'd interview a local estate agent in Dallas, given we're over here in America, and we've had a lot of inquiry about, you know, investing in America. Well, there are some of the ways you can do it, but also there are some dangers around property management, around, you know, being
currency
on the
risk,
other
distance,
side of the world, all of those things. So, yeah, just be careful in terms of what you're planning to do in this marketplace.
And he's very gracious to show us around, see some of the estates. We saw the definition of why everything's big in Texas. Everything is big in Texas. But we even got Ivis to go out for a traditional Texan barbecue lunch. So that was she was a reluctant participant, but in the end she loved it. So hey, my life hack today is at the back of the conference. So, you know, during one of the breaks, I happened to see this young lady. She had her iPad, and I caught my attention what she was looking at, Ben, and it was Google Flights.
Okay.
I thought, wow, what is that? So I went and checked it out, and you can actually use Google Flights, Ben, for a flight comparison service between all of the airlines and book. So it's like they're trying to compete in the space of some of the other aggregators. But I kind of thought twice about whether or not I wanted to give this as a life hack, Ben, because Google knows a lot about us. They're taking over the world. But there you go, folks. Check that out if you're looking for a flight comparison service. Google Flights, I checked it out. It actually works in Australia.
Yep.
So it could be an alternative to one of the other flight comparison services.
Yeah, Webjet.
Flight Centre.
Last Minute, those types of sites.
Yep. So check it out, folks. If you're in a hurry to find a flight, Google knows everything else about you. So, in fact, when I tested it, Ben, they already knew my flight back already. So it's just scary how much they know.
Scary.
So check that out. Did you know?
Did you know, Bryce? So here we are in Dallas. So I thought I'd give a few stats on Dallas and a couple of little interesting facts. So the first one, that Dallas is actually the 9th largest city in the US.
Oh, wow.
Dallas is. Mm. But it's the 3rd largest city in Texas. So there are 2 other cities in Texas that are bigger than Dallas.
Is it Houston and San Antonio?
Possibly. Mm. I mean, you know, Dallas, Texas is a massive state here. So that's just one bit. So about 1.3 million people. Mm. And as we heard from Jeff, you know, it's a booming city, Dallas. It's going really, really well. But here's some interesting facts, you know, that might get you. The frozen margarita machine was invented in Dallas.
I did not know that.
Frozen margarita.
Yep.
In Dallas.
Yep.
Second thing, the integrated circuit computer chip, which became the microchip,
yep,
that obviously sat in computers, was invented in Dallas in 1958.
Surely not. I thought everything was invented in Scotland.
Everything in Scotland? Whiskey was invented in Scotland, wasn't it?
My brother-in-law reckons everything comes from Scotland.
Now, Lamar Hunt was the founder of the American Football League, and he's the son of the oil tycoon H.L. Hunt, and he was noted in Dallas as a Dallas resident who coined the phrase Super Bowl.
Oh, yeah. Started here.
So that's where the Super Bowl came from a local Dallas resident.
Mm-mm.
And I think it's caught on.
Mm. Yeah, well, very good stuff, mate. I didn't know any of that whatsoever, so very good insights that the listeners get to have. And, mate, we ticked off a bucket list item too, didn't we? We went to an NBA game
at
the Dallas Mavericks. Yeah. And we just missed out on seeing number one draft pick Ben Simmons.
Yes, it would have been nice to see Ben play.
On Saturday night.
Australian who's smashing it over here, basically, in his first true season after being injured last year.
So there we go, a bit of sports banter at the end instead of the beginning. Ben,
yeah. Well, we haven't talked about footy for a while, so now we're on to the NBA basketball and the NFL, given that we're over here in the States.
Exactly, and of course we stood in the on the road where the X was, where JFK was shot today as well. So it's a big trip to Dallas, but Ben will probably have to sign off here and make a run to our flight, and just hope that the listeners got some benefit out of that American context. And mate, until next week.
Remember, Bryce, knowledge is empowering, but only if you act on it.
See you guys.